Good morning and welcome to the Monday call. I'm Stefan Clark, Chief Client Officer at NZ Funds, and I'm joined by Mark Brooks, Head of Income and Principal at the firm too. They say technology is eating the world. From the simplest of tasks to the most complex challenges, technology is reshaping the fabric of our societies and creating incredible opportunities for investors. After a difficult 2022, the US tech-heavy index, the NASDAQ, has been the best performing major index worldwide, driven up by investor optimism around AI and the resilience of the sector. This week, we're joined by Raina Dobbelman, Investment Officer at MFS Investment Management, to discuss investing in technology, the latest trends, and where MFS see the current opportunities. MFS manage over $400 billion US of assets for individuals, families, and institutions around the world, and is one of a select group of investment managers NZ Funds partners with. Raina, it is a delight to have you here. Welcome.
Thank you.
I believe where you are, it's the morning. Whereabouts are you? And if you wouldn't mind, well, tell us a little bit about your role and how you found yourself at MFS.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here. I'm in Holland, just outside The Hague, where it's a gray and rainy 18 degrees Celsius, which is reasonably typical for a Dutch summer, but I don't mind. I actually enjoy this. I enjoy all the weather also when it's sunny. But MFS, I run a technology portfolio, and also I'm co-sector head for technology, heading up our technology team of analysts who advise the portfolio managers. And collectively, analysts at MFS manage about $40 billion US. It's probably a larger number today, but it's a significant part of the total assets that we manage is managed directly by analyst teams. And that actually is why I joined MFS. Everyone at MFS is an investor. Analysts are not, you know, librarians or historians. We're there to generate alpha directly. And it makes communication with the portfolio managers much easier. We're all on the same page in terms of how we think about the stocks and trying to refine, you know, the excess of information we get every day into information that is relevant to generating alpha.
Righto. And what drew you to, I guess, technology and building a career in that sector?
I went to business school in California at Berkeley, and it was early 90s. And I was super excited about what could happen with technology. Computers, PCs were the thing at the time. And then tragically, after business school, I moved to Japan. And I'd, you know, done projects on Oracle and software. And I was going to do a neural programming project with one of my B school professors. I went early to Japan. And for 20 years, 95 to 2005. I think it's fair to say that for 20 years, Japan was the graveyard of technology, especially software. in a way, that was a horrible experience because I was watching from the sidelines, just the whole Bay Area, San Francisco, Berkeley, exploding with innovation. And, I was in Japan where it was going the other way. But it was a fantastic experience as an investor because it was a bear market and there was multiple contraction, and I learned how to deal with that. And that's a rare experience that not many investors, at least at US firms, have had. So it does help, you know, inform my investment process.
And probably contextualize the last couple of years, perhaps.
Yeah, although, you know, the COVID and post-COVID environment is like nothing I've ever seen. You know, Japan was a grind and a lot of rotation. And this has been sort of like a roller coaster in space because, you know, you have unreliable information coming from, you know, multiple sources. You have an environment of fear. We're all, you know, and dislocation. You know, a lot of people experienced a huge variety of dislocations during the COVID period, and not to mention, you know, sickness and death in some cases. So, you know, a lot of emotional impact on the thinking process. And then just a stock market, which, you know, the U.S. provided, what, $5 trillion in stimulus or something, and then a quarter of GDP, roughly. And then, you know, 22, very tough down market, but very fast. And then over in October and up we go again. And, you know, so it's this is more like being, you know, being like a bug on the tail end of a whip and going, whoom, you know, you're still on the whip, but you're getting shaken up and shaken down. And yeah.
Has that changed the way in which you think about stocks? Because obviously it's hard to see us going back to that sort of Japanese grind market.
Yeah, it is.
Just the world just gets so much quicker.
Yes. Well, so it's not, you know, if you come into this, it started my career with a Benjamin Graham mindset, you know, that textbook. And you have to be flexible in an environment where capital, you know, capital cost approach is zero. And understand that, you know, we're always looking at relative valuation in the first place. So, you know, a stock is not cheap or expensive on an absolute basis. We're valuing it relative to its universe. So if the universe is at 50 times PE or 10 times sales or 20 times sales, well, that's the benchmark, right? Which is
how do you sort of marry that with a Graham-like starting point? I suppose that's, well, yeah, if,
yeah,
at a personal level, that's kind of what I've struggled with over time is, yeah, I'm not a great tech investor myself mentally, being a bond guy.
Yeah,
doesn't come naturally. So sort of marrying that sort of value versus not extreme growth, but you know what I mean.
Yes. Well, you know, you do relative valuation. So if, you know, 10% growth is worth 30 times PE, just to pick a, you know, set of random numbers, not a historical number. Then you try to deal with it. But obviously on a human level, you know, that's uncomfortable. You know, I can't get past that really. I mean, emotionally. So it just makes it difficult. It's still, you know, a relative game in the sense that, you know, you're looking for the best, most sustainable growth and returns at the best price. So that part of the discipline is still important, you know, accurately trying to measure, yep, the growth, accurately trying to predict what returns will be. And that's a function of industry structure. You know, how competitive is it? How deep are the moats? Is this a business that has, you know, sort of a virtuous cycle at the, you know, the network effect, like the bigger they get and the harder they get to dislodge. Those things still apply, but they're happening. But there's also a level of arbitrariness and a willingness by the market to sort of buy things on faith and not test them. And since there's no capital discipline, you can get away with these sort of fantasy scenarios for longer.
Yep.
Which is frustrating for curmudgeonly analysts. That's frustrating.
And do you separate within a sector US names versus global? Because otherwise, you're probably going to end up always buying the global because it may have similar growth.
Yeah, on a valuation basis. So I have, and the team has, the analyst team has a number of different mandates, and they sort of, if you think of a pyramid. At the bottom of the pyramid are these regional funds, like a Japan fund or an Asia ex-Japan fund. And then, you know, you get gradually more global on the way up until you're doing global. And the benchmarks, even for the global portfolios, are, you know, two-thirds U.S. So it tends to be somewhat in line with that. And we're not super skewed to any one region other than that. In the last few years, we have added a lot to Japan because Japan has a reasonably good valuation for, you know, the quality of the business you're acquiring. So an example there is Hitachi, is a stock we've owned for many, many years over there, and has been, you know, sort of a low, under 10 PEs, now mid-teens PE, not seen as a growth company, and sort of headline growth is negative, because they're divesting from businesses. So, you know, comparing to last year, they had this, you know, auto parts business. It's not here this year. So, you know, revenues look down. But if you look underneath the covers, it's growing like 10%.
Sort of classic sum of the parts type.
Yeah.
Modeling.
Okay. So we touched on COVID, but how, I mean, as a starting point for the meat and potatoes of the conversation, how do you sort of think about market dynamics today and the rise of the NASDAQ's, you know, seemingly unending rise over the course of this year, and the fact that the Dow's, you know, on the other side of the equation, and you know, other markets, Australia, New Zealand, for example, Europe, definitely haven't had anything like the stellar run that the NASDAQ has. How do you think about, you know, tech versus, you know, industrials and more cyclical yes. stocks today?
Yes. So first a caveat, I'm a bottom-up investor, bottom-up fundamental investor. So any comments I have about markets or macro, you know, you're not asking the most qualified person around. And I don't have a lot of faith in like predicting indices. But I'll say, you know, we try to be aware of the environment, that the NASDAQ environment, the tech environment in the US is hot. And I agree that we don't see that in other markets where technology stocks trade. If you look at Samsung Electronics or TSMC, you know, widely recognized global technology companies, they've underperformed. You know, on a one-year basis, they've underperformed the U.S. technology stocks. Obviously,
Taiwan
China
semis on like a 20 times PE or something even less, isn't it?
Yeah, that's correct.
Yeah.
China technology stocks, sort of the bloom is off the rose there as well, and it doesn't look like that's going to come back. Certainly not driven by, you know, non-Chinese investors, just because of the geopolitical situation. And as a U.S. investor, you can't be sure that you'll be allowed to invest in China in the next 5 years. It might continue. I hope it continues. I hope we all stay friendly. But, you know, there could be increasing restrictions on what we're allowed to do. How do we deal with it? Let me get back to your question then on, you know, how do we think about the NASDAQ and U.S. tech stocks? Again, it's a relative game, and we're being forced to play in a more valuation aggressive, high valuation environment. At the same time, I think there's a clear secular driver now, and it's still relatively small, but at least for the next 3 to 5 years, it's going to be really important. And that's AI. That's sort of the killer app, you know. It was funny. We visited NVIDIA in June, and Jensen Huang came. He's very generous with his time. And you know, one of the things he said is like, AI is the killer app. I hate that word. I don't want to kill anybody. But it's the reason why you need to have NVIDIA equipment, because, as he put it, AI is like money squirting out of computers. The monetization is so quick, assuming you have the, you know, right downstream set of apps, for example, Microsoft. It's so quick that it's just driving a very intense investment cycle. And I mean, that's typical of what you see in tech. You know, the first spreadsheet calculator, VisiCalc, in the early 80s, Lotus 1-2-3, maybe you remember, those made PCs suddenly relevant in the business environment. And this is, you know, another iteration of that, only on turbo and steroids.
And that sort of takes us, I suppose, maybe down a tangent of the semiconductor space. It does seem that going forward, there's no shortage of chips, but there's a real shortage of the right chips. And
yes.
How long that typically that's been a very defined semiconductor cycle over time.
Yes.
Where do you sort of think we are in that process?
Well, going back to first principles on semis, and I'm a semis analyst, and have been for most of my career, all of my career. The thing that drives this cycle is the mismatch in timing between demand and the ability to add capacity. So it takes at least 6 months and often 12 to 18 months to add semiconductor capacity. And, you know, demand can change in a month or a week. And once you've built the capacity, because the fixed costs associated are so high, if you have too much, it has a, you know, the incremental profits, the effect on margins is really, really high. So just to baseline that for the audience, it's true that, so this is one of the, it's the only semiconductor cycle I can think of where there is high dispersion between semiconductor economics, companies, but also the stocks. So NVIDIA should be doing really well, and it is. but if you take a, you know, a tier two foundry, it's tough. Even for TSMC, you know, they're seeing declining profits in the last quarter, I think. So anyway, it's a horrible quarter. Q1, Q2 are horrible. For the memory companies, also Samsung, Hynix, et cetera, you know, the first negative margins, in fact, the only negative quarterly margins I can recall for Samsung Electronics going back into to 99. And it'll be, I think, a loss-making year for memory for them. And that's also a first. And who would have thought that in an industry with three players, right, where margins going into pre-down cycle were 40, 50, as high, almost 70% in 2018. I think those numbers give you a little sample of how dislocated things are, how different from the past, and how outside sort of the bands of standard deviation. So it's a, it's exciting. It's scary.
So is that a function of just a change in the demand, or is it more a supply side piece where they ramp up scale?
That's a that magnitude is a supply side effect where they built too much capacity, and now, and this is unusual in DRAM. In DRAM, even under bad DRAM is a memory product. Under bad conditions, when demand is low, you still run your fab at 100% utilization, because the equipment and all the facilities are so expensive that that's the cheapest way to sort of divide the cost over as many chips as you can. They were running, everyone in the industry is running like 80% or something. That's highly unusual. And not just a quarter or a month, but like two quarters. Why did that happen? I think it goes back to my comments about the COVID period where, you know, you had that period where you couldn't get stuff. There was all that supply chain disruption. And there were multiple reasons for it. Some of it was that people had underplanned capacity. Some of it was just that, you know, the truck couldn't get to your place, or the ship couldn't get to your place, or checkpoints took too long because of the disease threat. And it was a lousy information environment. And as a result, the memory companies overbuilt. Their client, their customers told them, build, we need more. You know your customers are over ordering, but you don't know if they're triple, quadruple, or quintuple order. You know, you just, the analogy that's always used for a supply chain like is the bullwhip effect. I think this is really interesting in that, you know, when you crack a whip, you move your hand, you know, I don't know how fast, but not too fast, but the end of that whip is moving supersonically. And the supersonic part is where the semiconductor makers are. So they get this customer signal and it's magnified massively. That causes this sort of dislocation.
So is NVIDIA now the envy of all chip makers because they were in a different
NVIDIA
place
is
the nature of the chips is different from other semiconductor makers, is my understanding.
Yes, the way I see it is it's much more than a chip company. So if you think back to the 1990s, there were four companies that dominated their ecosystems. It was Intel, Microsoft, you know, the Wintel, that dominated PCs. Then you had Dell, who dominated the assembly of PCs, as a great business model for that. And then you had Cisco, who did the networking between PCs and data centers as they existed back then. And they were just incredible stocks in the 1990s. And I think NVIDIA is all of those put together. but for this era. And the reason is they have these chips, and yes, their GPUs are far superior to their competitions, particularly for certain specific AI applications. But they also have built a software stack around that or on top of it to enable people to use the chips for a more productive purpose, in order to make them more turnkey. And that they've been doing that for 15 years. So they have a huge lead. And so that's the Microsoft part of it, the operating system. The chips were the Intel part. Then they have a bunch of highly specialized networking, cabling protocols, IP, and chips that are specific for high-performance systems that do the networking between the chips, because we're in a parallel processing world, right? Where you know, you have multiple chips working together to sort of take a task apart, process it, and then put it back together. And then they also have some broader networking technology that competes a little bit with Ethernet, which is the most common network, so between data center networking. And so that's the Cisco part. And then the Dell part is that they have, essentially, they can provide you with a solution that you know, you could plug right into your software stack. When I say your, it takes a company like ServiceNow or Microsoft or something, you know, Google, to apply that. I can't do it. MFS can't do it just like that. Probably we can't even buy the systems now, but that's how it works. So it's very, very powerful position that, you know, has some durability to it. 5-10 years would be my guess.
Before the competition catch up.
But yeah, I think current market share is around 90%. That might go to 80%, but then you're at a solid 80% and you stay there for a long time until some new disruption comes along.
Okay. A lot of this rests on this, and I can see you're really enthusiastic about the impact of AI.
Yes. Yeah.
And
I'm also scared.
we'll touch on that soon, but just on from an investor's perspective, a lot of capital is being pushed towards AI opportunities, both at a private market and a public market sense. How do you think about the impact and that AI generally is going to have on society and GDP and the corporates that are the customers of these benefactors of all this investment capital?
How do I think about the impact on society? Yes.
Yeah. So how do you? Because obviously, underpins a lot of the investment propositions that you know, Nvidia, for example, the foundation for it is AI.
Yes.
So you must have a really strong bull case for AI generally and AI demand.
Yes. I'm going, you know, this is typical for bottom up. I'm going off their guidance revision. I'm going off the comments we've gotten from other companies in the universe. And just the history of tracking AI over the last 10 years where it's been most visible. Normally, on an event like this, so the events that changed our minds was when NVIDIA announced their results and then provided a guide for the next quarter that was insanely off base, high. Normally I'm a seller of news, you know, where it's like, yes, you know, in the short run, we overestimate how quickly technology will change our lives, but in the long run, we underestimate it. But I think two things. So one is this environment since 2020 is a different environment. One thing I've learned from that environment is you have to be quick. The other is AI is different in that it accelerates the rate of change. There's a book called The Second Machine Age, I think, and they compare the development of broad, you know, machine intelligence to the Industrial Revolution and the evolution of the steam engine and everything that came out of that. And that happened very slowly. This is going to happen really fast. And the analogy they use in the book is that chess analogy where, you know, the king playing chess with the person who invented chess, and the inventor wins and the king says, oh, you can have anything you want. And the guy says, okay, I just want some rice. Like, double the amount of rice that you put on each square. And, you know, it's an example of the power law and how you get exponential change. But by the time you're halfway across the board, it's filling the room. The rice is filling the room. It's so much. It's way more than you can intuitively grasp. And I think AI is like that. So we have to be really fast. And also change fast. Like, it won't be unidirectional. Or the other thing we know about technology cycles is it's never a straight line, right? It's some squiggle, and we just have to be responsive to the data that we get.
And that's from, I guess, from an investment's perspective, which companies you're investing in, or do you think about it and you've got to be fast in terms of how you transact and into positions, or is it more in the context of how you think about the industry more broadly and the research you're doing?
Kind of all of those. So, yes, we have to think about the industry and the research we're doing on a faster cadence, or at least anticipate faster change. And in terms of our investment decisions, we tend to, since we're, you know, we do a lot of things through discussion, and that takes time. So we're not going to be the fastest house in the market and never have been. And so our approach to that has been to slow down even more and, you know, really pick opportunities. And so typically, you know, in this example, you get revision up, stock up, 2 months later, stock down, next exciting thing happens, you know, slight disappointment. Oh, there's a hiccup with production, or it didn't ship, or like the plastic on the box didn't work. And, you know, because the multiple is so high, any disappointment has an effect on the share price. And that's when we would begin a position. And then you wait for opportunities like that to add to the position. Can't do that this time. You just have to get on board. And yeah, that's uncomfortable. Sorry.
And in terms of your actual day-to-day research, has AI changed anything in that yet? Have you been able to use it in your own research, or
I wish I had. There's some security concerns. Like, we can't just use off the shelf and like use our own queries and data, et cetera, for ChatGPT. And it's for the quantitative part of the work, I don't have a solution at the moment, or we don't have a solution. So Microsoft has this thing called Copilot. This application called Copilot. I don't know if it's available. We haven't rolled it out, but I've seen the demos where they show you, okay, this is, tell us what you want to do, to just talk to the AI and tell it what you want to do, and it will automate it for you. And you know, if you've worked on a computer, this is a dream, because it takes away all the tasks that you hate. The repetitive tasks, the stuff that doesn't work, the AI is there to help you with it. That's just that. I don't know how many dollars per month that would be worth. Right. 100, 200, 300, 400. That's not what they're charging or going to charge or have announced that they've charged, but that's worth a lot.
I'm just immediately thinking of a whole range of things I could use it for. Like,
yes,
every reply thanks to all emails I've received today. Mark and I, before the call, we were talking about AI and how it's already creating a lot of content itself, and the idea that there's a feedback loop where, because AI is based on content that's on the internet generally, yes, it'll start learning from its own content.
Yes.
And eventually you're just going to have this sort of self-reinforcing feedback loop of AI creating more content,
does it eat itself ultimately?
Yes. Well, you see it. You see it in some of the artwork. About a year ago, I started using Twitter because I felt like I had to know. I'm not on any social media except that, and that, not under my own name. And observing that platform and the AI, so people put their own videos from TikTok on there sometimes. And these people are you know, you start with a raw image, and then that image is processed, and the skin glows, and, you know, the proportions are perfect, and the, you know, the head is, and but there's also sort of this slight kind of offness to them. They're too round or something, or too shiny, or too, so there's, you know, it's still an unsophisticated.
It sounds like you're describing my head, to be honest.
No, I mean, it's like these, the shoulders, so yes, AI is generating its own content and it's feeding on itself, and it's probably feeding it based on views and length of engagement per image. So that's what I mean about being in an unreliable information environment, especially if you're in media, on social media. More, you know, we don't know how much of that content is bot driven, but I expect it would be a really, really high percentage. Bot, you know, automated, now AI.
Let's talk about companies that you're most excited about at the moment. What are there particular industries or within, or, you know, subsectors within technology?
Ones other than NVIDIA.
Yeah, besides NVIDIA, we've had the plug for that.
Yes.
Yeah. Where else are you looking, and are there, you know, what parts of the sector are you most focused on?
Well, you know, you mentioned the Dow earlier, and the Dow, I've noticed, had a little uptick. It's starting to look like it has some energy. And I think, so we own one company that's an example of this in the technology fund. It's Hitachi, which is historically an industrial conglomerate, everything from rice cookers to nuclear power plants. And they've kind of concentrated their portfolio of businesses, so they do fewer things today, but they are still at heart an industrial and IT company. And so they're really at the nexus of this, taking industrial processes and implying more what we'd think of as, you know, office, Microsoft Office type intelligence to them, or you know, advanced ERP, enterprise resource platforms that are more intuitive, friendly to use, and provide information that's relevant that you can make business decisions based off of. So analytics. And I think that whole field is super exciting. Not that one company, obviously, but also, by the way, that's something that Microsoft is also involved in, and a bunch of vertical software companies do that kind of thing. But also, you know, the Siemenses, Honeywell, Schneider, those sorts of companies. So that's it. I think for us as people, for the stock market, that's interesting, you know, and I think, I don't know about around the world, but in the US, infrastructure is really bad. So sort of the physical world since COVID is when I stopped using that phrase, software is eating the world, which I took that to mean that more and more is happening in software. More relevance is happening in software than in the physical world. COVID took us right back into the physical world and said, yeah, you have to pay attention to where your body is relative to other bodies, you know, relative to your house, etc. And also we couldn't get stuff. And I think that shift, we're kind of cyclically in this shift where physical matters again. But it's happening within the context of a software infrastructure, an internet infrastructure that has all this information in it as well. So it's different from the 80s or the 70s or the 90s, but it's relative to the last 20 years, it's more, physical is more important. And I think there's a lot to do there. I don't have a specific grasp of exactly what, you know, and how that's going to play out. But, you know, electrical grids is one. Hitachi is a provider of equipment for electrical grids that are analytic, that can be, that's really important in the age of renewables, because renewables are unreliable. You know, the wind doesn't always blow, so you have to allocate where the power is coming from intelligently and store it intelligently and shift between. So it's, you know, those things are important.
Okay. And how do you think about the China technology industry versus the US? Is that, you mentioned earlier that as an investor, you're worried about being able to continue to invest there, given geopolitical factors. But as an industry, my understanding is China is catching up with the, you know, with the US. Do you think that that's true? And are you seeing particular names there that are an expression of that that excite you?
Or the other one I'd add to that is, are they materially hampered by the chip availability of truly cutting edge?
Yes. That's GPUs. A really serious set of events. So I think I take Chinese technology very seriously. We used to own a lot of Tencent. It's from a business and technology point of view, a great platform. You can have some ESG issues with it. I would say on the software and sort of internet, so hyperscale side, I would take China very seriously. There was a period where they filed more AI patents than anybody else by, you know, a factor of two or something. Now, who knows, right? Patents, they're not all relevant or important. But so I take it very seriously. You know, they have the scale, they have the quality of education, they have good infrastructure. So it's a powerful combination for generating innovation and products that have value. I would say, though, that it's hard for me as a technology investor based in the US to do much, because again, I'm worried that unpredictably I'll be told, Rainier, we got to get out. We can't own this stuff anymore. And you know, hopefully you have a window, but then you're selling with everybody else. That's an uncomfortable environment. I don't think things will get hot or kinetic. I hope they don't, and I hope things in general get better, because I think the world's better off when we're all, we have our disagreements, but we remain friends. So what the US have done with the chip equipment sanctions, those are crippling to China's semiconductor industry. So you're stuck 5 years behind the rest of the world, basically forever, as long as those restrictions apply. If the US, if this had been done to the US, I think the US would call it an act of war. It's very, it's quite aggressive. And, I agree something has to be done, but this is very aggressive. That said, though, China's local chip industry, mostly tier two foundry, they're reasonably good at sort of the 28 nanometer and slightly better node level. And, that's perfectly viable. It's just subscale for them. So what I hear from my companies is that they're, buying as much equipment as they can while they can get hold of it and trying to expand as much as possible. They want to be self-sufficient in chips, but they're far, far away from that level.
The US seems to want to, is onshoring chip manufacturers at the moment, isn't it, too?
Yes, and I think that's part of another change that we've seen in the last 3 years, is that the importance of having local supply for strategic goods, including food, is really important. And so, I think it makes sense for Europe, for the US, for China to have some localized chip production. It won't be cheap, and it won't help the ROIs for the industry, but we're sacrificing efficiency for resiliency is what you read a lot.
I read an MFS article that I don't believe you published it, but one of your colleagues published it, which I'm sure you've seen, which is the increase in data usage over the next couple of decades. And it has effectively an exponential curve to it.
Yes.
Now, we are creating an incredible amount of data as it is, and we are now producing tools that are creating an incredible, even more data, and do it in an automatic way. What does this sort of, big shift mean for the companies that you're focused on? There are some benefactors to large data, and there obviously will be some challenges that we face.
Yeah, so we've gone from this environment, if you go back to, the Middle Ages, the paradigm for me is Name of the Rose by Umberto Eco.
I've read it. It's a great book.
Yeah. And he's a great author. He wrote basically the example of this library with all this valuable knowledge. Knowledge was scarce. Then we went to, you know, starting around the 70s, information, we won't call it knowledge, was abundant. And the trick became, you know, how do you process all that stuff? And it's just gotten worse from there. Now it's so much of it is just wrong, fake, meant to deceive you, meant to correct, but meant to manipulate you. You know, the correct, right information at the wrong time can have a serious effect on your mental health. So how does it affect the companies in my universe? The irony is the storage companies who make hard disks or memory, they're in horrible economic positions currently. Now it's going to get better. It's been the bottom. You know, the Q2 is the bottom, and it sequentially gets better from here. But it won't be a pretty 2023 for these companies. And so, you know, I guess the quick answer, I don't have a great answer for you, is that anything that processes data, filters, especially to get the garbage, the toxic stuff out, that's really valuable. And that comes back to AI. But then you have to trust the AI. And the issue with the AI is it's a black box. So you don't really know, you can't reverse engineer how it gets to its decisions. If you have a sensor who says, this is not allowed, at least you know, okay, they made their decisions because, you know, for these criteria, right? And so we can change those criteria. But
fantastic. Okay, Rainer, thank you so much for your time. I'm going to let you get on with your day. I hope the weather improves in Holland.
Thank you.
And it's miserable here. And
it's also winter.
It's winter rather than summer, so some form of excuse. But have a wonderful one, and we really appreciate you taking your time, and look forward to seeing the AI phenomenon play out.
Yes, thank you.
This has been the Monday Call, brought to you by NZ Funds. New Zealand Funds Management Limited is the issuer of the NZ Funds KiwiSaver Scheme, the NZ Funds Managed Superannuation Service, the NZ Funds Advised Portfolio Service, the NZ Funds Wealth Builder, and NZ Funds Income Generator. A product disclosure statement for each is available at nzfunds.co.nz. Past performance is not necessarily an indicator of future returns.